All right. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the midterm review session. Not a ton of announcements. Obviously, midterm will be on Tuesday. I'm taking questions today, so we'll keep going as long as there's questions. Just a reminder that the homework is due on Friday, and because of the class disruption on Tuesday, we won't do a quiz this week. We have been sort of focusing our effort on the midterm. Our plan, roughly speaking, is to sort of between the class on Thursday next week and then after the break, sort of figure out how to kind of get things back on schedule with the two sections being earlier class had one extra class. So we'll sort of figure that out afterwards. But in the meantime, focus on the midterm. Any sort of logistical questions or anything before we get into it? No, all good? Yeah?
As far as like practice resources and stuff, since there have not been previous exams, should we just like work through quizzes again? And, like what would you say is the best way to?
Yeah, so as far as resources to review, certainly going over quiz questions you missed, great idea. The exercises from the lecture, great idea. The past exams are also, especially the more recent ones, are also very useful. It's a good way to sort of check your understanding. You should be able to identify a question where you're like, yes, we covered this material, or, oh no, that's still coming in the second half of the course. So the practice exams that are posted are finals, especially the recent ones, and so some of the material we haven't gotten to yet. So it should be pretty obvious, right? It's like a question, it's like, wait a minute, none of this looks familiar. And so we're only going through direct caches. But I think those are all great, places to start. The other thing that you can do, if you haven't thought about this in the past, is how would you write a question, right? You've seen the quiz questions. You've seen kind of what the style is trying to ask. If you pick a topic and think, if I was going to write an exam question, what might I think about? Right, that can be a great way to have to think through, like, what's the most important thing? How can I get it so that it would fit in a reasonable amount of, reasonable section of paper, and that it would take a reasonable amount of time? Kind of putting yourself in the other side can be very productive as well. Anything else? Yeah. Yeah, so what's the structure going to be? I think the recent practice exams from the last couple semesters should give you a pretty good idea. And so there will be some sort of short response, although not really like, not essay questions, some choose all that apply kind of questions. I think the style of questions from the last couple practice exams are a pretty good reflection. Yeah?
Is it going to be on paper?
Will the midterm be on paper or sort of like through the same site as the quizzes? It'll be on paper here in this room. Okay, all right. So you may have seen this, asked for some questions on Piazza. And sort of added, a few sort of topics have come up. I'm happy to go over these. Are there other questions specifically that would be helpful to look at? Okay, all right. Nothing nothing additional. So we'll just kind of dive into these. And of course, please ask questions along the way. All right, so first topic here is building and make. Let me load this here. Okay, great. Okay, so linker, just kind of a reminder. So we have two common tools, GCC and Clang. They're kind of helpful because we can run the same executable, do compilation step or linking step. Generally, our sort of argument structure, you know, will be some options and flags for different optimization or platforms, whatever. We're going to have a host of object files, commonly. Those are the pre-compiled binaries that we want to link together into our output executable. We might have other libraries or archives that we're including. We'll often have a -o with our exe name. Oops. And then there were a couple other flags that we saw that are sort of linker specific. So lowercase l, and then a library name. So for example, a common one is m for the math library. And this is saying there's a shared library that I want to use. Please include that when linking this program. And oftentimes, these will be sort of system-wide shared libraries that we expect to be sort of installed with the tool chain. There's also capital L, which takes a path, and this is a way for the linker to sort of include information about where to find libraries. So if we're using system libraries, those are usually in a known location that our programs can find. However, if we're sort of including our own custom libraries, we may need to specify an additional path, and we can help the linker include that by using the capital L flag. So those are the sort of the, you know, the key pieces there. Good? All right. So let's look at the fall. Let me pull this up here a second. Fall 23. Open. Question 9, okay. All right, so here we're given sort of a example make file, and we're given the information, right? That this should be working. Okay, that something's wrong here. So first of all, what looks off about that particular part of the make file? Yeah. Right. It's sort of odd that we're specifying .c files as the input. Generally, we would expect those to be .o files because that's what we typically would include when building the final executable, right? And so definitely this looks suspicious. And so now we're given a list of problems that could occur if we were to run make all, and we do have an all target here. And so let's just kind of go through these. All right, so if utility.h is modified, we run make all, then make does not correctly rebuild the application. So utility.h is specified as a dependency for a couple things, including main.o and utility.o. However, utility.h is not specified as a dependency for application, and nor are the output files, the object files, which themselves include utility.h as an input dependency. And so as far as make is concerned, if utility.h changes, there's no need to rebuild application because it doesn't depend on that as an input. And so we won't actually end up rebuilding that. Okay. Now, we modify utility.h, but then we don't rebuild main.o. Well, if we look at this here, right, utility.h is specified. So if this changes, make knows that it needs to rerun this recipe to get the correct main.o. So we do expect that to work. What if utility.c is modified? Will we rebuild utility.o? Well, we can see from this rule here that utility.c is specified correctly as we would expect it to be, and so make knows that if this utility.c file changes, we need to rebuild utility.o, so that should be good. What about the last two here? So will there be a file not found error for main.c? Well, it's possible that main.c just doesn't exist. But given this make file, you know, we can sort of reasonably assume that because it's specified as an input, you know, here, that the file will exist. So either sort of all of these, you know, will fail because the file isn't found and there's nothing that's going to generate main.c. However, we expect that that's just a traditional source file. It's not something that the make system needs to build. And so we expect that we won't get a file not found error for that. However, what about main.o? So that's a file that is generated. When we run make all, make looks at this recipe here and says, okay, I just need main.c and utility.c. Both of those are source files. Those should exist. I can go ahead and run this recipe to build application, so I can run this command. But oh, wait, right? This command needs main.o. But that hasn't been generated. And so, you know, this rule is specified first. If it runs first, this file won't exist yet. And so we should expect an error for that. Yeah?
Does make always rebuild the dependencies in order from left to right?
Does make always rebuild the dependencies in order from, like, in that sort of order? Application, then main.o, then utility.o? I believe so. With the big caveat that make also has like parallel operation modes where it's figuring out which recipes can be run at the same time and then using multiple cores on a machine to do so. And so we certainly don't want to rely on the behavior of assuming that things will get built in a certain way. But I think in practice that because application's listed first, make will execute that first, at least in its current form. All right. Any other questions on this one? Okay, let's go. All right. Okay, Spring. Okay. Okay, so sort of a similar style question here. We're trying to build this program. We've got a few C files, we've got the corresponding header files. We're given some information. So both main.c and parsing.c include utilities.h. Main.c also includes parsing.h. And so the question is, what do we need to specify here as the dependencies to have this be a correct and valid make recipe to build this as we expect? So if we look at our list of options here, certainly, right, we're seeing that there's an output here, and that matches our output. So that's what we expect. Main.c, therefore, is an input directly to this command. And so we better have that as one of our input dependencies, because the command is directly referencing that file. But what else do we need? So when we have header files, if main.c is including that header file, and so here, right, main.c uses functions in parsing.c and then includes parsing.h, what that's essentially doing is the preparser is just taking that header file and inserting it into the source file there. And so we definitely need that file as an input. And if that header file changes, that might change the correct compilation of main.c. And so we're going to definitely need to include parsing.h. By the same logic, because main.c also includes utilities.h, and the preprocessor is inserting that header file into the source file during the compilation step, we also want to express that utilities.h is a dependency as well. And so if those header files change, that could have very material effects on how main.o should be generated. And so we want to make sure that this rule is rerun if those header files change. But we have some other options too. So we've sort of already ruled out main.o, right? Because that's an output. It doesn't make sense to then include that as an input as well. We're only looking at compiling main.o. We don't need a different object file. We're not generating a library or archive or the final executable. We're just creating the main.o compiled binary. And so we're not going to have like these other object files as well. That doesn't make sense. Another one here is this main.s. So .s is typically an assembly file. There's no mention of a main assembly file. Now, there's ways to get the compiler to generate the corresponding assembly file from what it compiles, but we're not asking it to do that here. And even if we were, that would still be an output. So it doesn't make sense that main.s, which doesn't really exist in this case, would be an input. Okay, and so now we have these last two, which are the C files. Should those be expressed as inputs? And the answer is no, because we want to be able to compile separate C files to separate object files. And those object files are kept separate. They're used in the linking step. And so at compiling these objects, it's okay. The compiler is like, okay, I know that this function is defined in this header file. It's going to be included somewhere else. I don't need it right now. I will when we do the linking, but that's not the step we're on. And we don't want to include additional C files as dependencies because we don't want to have to rebuild this rule just because we changed some other source file. We just need to rerun the linking step for the final executable, but we don't need to recompile main.c just because some other C file changed. And so we don't want to include this or this. All right. Are assembly files typically outputs? I would say no. I think generally speaking, if we need to do something very low level, so writing an exception handler, we need very, very performant code where we want to know exactly which instructions are included, those types of things, we're writing assembly ourselves, and so it becomes an input. However, sometimes it is useful to be like, hey, compiler, what assembly are you generating here? And so we can have our compiler output the assembly it is generating, or at least the assembly representation of the machine code it's generating, but that's usually more for debugging or inspecting, not really in sort of a normal workflow of building a program. All right. All right, let's, how do we get back to this? Ah, there we go, okay. All right, so we looked at this. So let's talk a little bit about permissions. So there's a couple system calls, set UID, set group ID, that we talked a little bit about. We are more familiar with the sort of opposite, right? The get the UID, get the group ID, get the process ID, get the parent process ID. And so what are the sets for? Like, why would you, what's the use case for, say, setting your user ID? And the reason for this is that we talked about the special bit with the permissions where a program would execute not as the user that sort of started that program, but as the user that owns that program. And this is a really helpful technique for being able to run a program with different permissions. So for example, if you wanted to be able to mount a USB device, well, creating that, setting up that file system is not something that just any user on the system can do, but it would sure be convenient if anybody could have access to a USB device that they've plugged in. And so by setting that program as with the special bit, then it runs with elevated permissions. So that kind of solved a problem. But anytime we have something running with additional permissions, that's a little bit risky, right? We have these permissions so that we're only giving access to certain things. And so if there are bugs or security vulnerabilities, the potential impact is somewhat limited. However, sometimes we need additional permissions. And so to try to balance these things, oftentimes these programs will elect, they actually choose to sort of downgrade their permissions while doing a lot of their execution so that a lot of the code isn't running with the elevated permissions. And then they only switch back when they actually need to. And so functions like set UID, set group ID, give this flexibility to programs to be able to do this. It's just a way to sort of kind of balance the needs to have special permissions in certain cases while trying to minimize privilege to help ensure the robustness and security of the system. Yeah?
Does set GID also have the special permissions that allows you to represent your ID that you want?
No, so the special bit is separate. All right. So let's talk about, so we have kernel mode, user mode, and root. So one way to, so we often will depict this is sort of a structure like this where we kind of have this horizontal line, which is our system call interface, and that kind of separates where our processes run from the kernel. Now, we can have multiple processes, of course. We've talked a lot about that. And so we have user mode kind of above that line conceptually, kernel mode below. And this split is very important because we want to be able to run processes, multiple processes, processes from different developers, but we want to be able to do it in a way so that they're contained, they're isolated. If there's an issue with one of the processes, it shouldn't be able to compromise the rest of the system, either interrupt other processes or sort of create faults in the system. I shouldn't say that. Sort of unduly disrupt the system. And so that's why we have these separate operating modes. This way we can have things like the process run with its virtual memory, and it can call system calls. The kernel, on the other hand, is running in kernel mode, And because the kernel is responsible for overseeing all of the resources in the system, it needs to be able to do additional things that processes can't. However, at the end of the day, they're both compiled programs using the same instruction set. And so we actually need the hardware to give us different operating modes. So the user mode, when that's executing instructions, it's limited. It can't access everything. It can't run every instruction that the kernel mode can. And so if we want to switch between the two, that's where system calls come in. So we have a syscall instruction that user mode can call. That causes the hardware to be like, okay, I can handle this instruction, but I handle it by basically calling a particular exception handler in the kernel and letting the kernel figure out what it actually wants to do. And so other things that happen in user mode or the process, might execute, certain memory, which causes a page fault, call a system call, sort of other restrictions. Now, the kernel has to be in sort of a different mode because it needs to be able to actually be allowed to do more, right? Access other resources, other sort of peripherals on the system, et cetera. And so if the process calls a system call, that's going to cause an exception, which the kernel can then handle and decide what it wants to do. Maybe it permits that, maybe it doesn't. But it's up to the kernel. The kernel has the authority to decide. Now, there's one other concept, which is we don't necessarily want all processes to be treated exactly the same. So this process here might have, say, some user ID 100. But this is a special program which actually runs as the root user. And the purpose here is that some programs sort of need elevated permissions. So whereas a sort of normal program can't access all system files, a root program might need to be able to do that. And so we have this sort of convention that we can reserve user ID 0 for this. And now it's still a process, it's still running in user mode. So it says the same restrictions as any other process. It can't call certain instructions, et cetera. However, it's still going to communicate with the kernel via system calls. But now those system calls are probably going to be handled differently. Or the kernel is going to be like, okay, you're running as root. I'm going to allow certain things that I wouldn't allow to another process. And so this is very helpful to be able to both have sort of user level, sort of traditional programs, but then also more system management programs that run that can do additional things and maintain the system. All right. Is that sort of, hopefully that shows kind of the breakdown of these different ideas and kind of how they relate. Any questions? All right, cool. Talk about these things. Okay, so talk a little bit about copy on write and page fault lazy allocation. These are very sort of similar in flavor. So if you recall, when we talked about fork, what fork does is you've got a running process, and it basically makes an entire deep copy of itself, and now we have two running processes. Well, while conceptually that's sort of easy to describe, you can imagine if that original process had been doing a lot and allocating a lot of memory and had a lot of resources set up, to make that copy is going to be fairly expensive, right? Because it would have to sort of copy all of those data structures so that they're complete duplicates of each other. Yet, that new process may never actually use any of that memory, right? Perhaps we're just going to call exec and run a new program. And so all of that memory that was set up by the original parent process is never used. That's a lot of overhead and waste. And so what copy on write allows for is instead of doing that duplication at the beginning just kind of say, well, we've made a copy of it. Like, as far as the program, the second new process is concerned, there's absolutely a copy of it. But in practice, nothing's really been copied. Just there's a bit marked that if there is a write, then we need to do a copy. And so that's the copy on write. So if the program does end up modifying that memory, which is effectively shared between these two processes at this point, then we have to go and make a new copy for that second program. And so its page table entry will get updated, and then it will use sort of this new copy. And so rather than speculatively doing a bunch of extra work, we just kind of push it off to later and say, well, we'll only do the work if we actually need to. The page table lazy allocation is kind of a similar idea. We might run a process, tell it, hey, we set up all this room for your stack and your heap and this and that, while not actually taking physical memory and reserving it for that process just yet. Because who knows? Maybe that process, that program, will never actually use that much stack or actually use the resources we told it could have. So instead, we just kind of say, yeah, you have access to this. When or if the program does end up using it, the hardware will come back and say, wait a minute, I can't look up this memory address. It hasn't been allocated. And that will cause an exception to the operating system. The kernel can say, okay, yeah. Well, this is a valid lookup, so I'm now going to allocate that memory. And then we'll retry that lookup, and everything will be fine. But I'm only going to do that if I need to. I'm not going to do that in advance, and that's the lazy part. Any questions on that concept? Cool. All right. Just kind of briefly talking about signals. Right, so signals are our tool for allowing sort of events to be sent to individual processes, but mediated by the operating system. And so we can have some process running, some other process running in the kernel, and this process can send a signal from sort of this process to another process by using system calls that the kernel provides. And so like one way we saw that, right, is sending a signal via the kill system call. Now, by default, sort of in general, processes are not handling these signals. However, they can set up a signal handler. So we can have some signal handler with and be given what signal was actually delivered, right? And this sort of just is inside of the program, right? And it can do something. And we can tell the kernel, if I get this signal, I want you to run this handler. We can also mask signals. And so we can tell the kernel, I don't want you to deliver a particular signals to me. Now, not all signals can be masked, but things like user, interrupt, right, those can be masked to basically tell the operating system, if the signal is sent to me, just hold on to it, right? Don't deliver it. And then finally, we had a sig wait interface to be able to say, rather than doing sort of this running this function, this particular handler function, and one of the challenges there is that handler function could sort of run at any time in our program, and so we have to be very careful about what we actually do inside of that handler to make sure we're not corrupting the memory that our system is using. And so instead, we can sort of wait and say, okay, I'm not going to continue, I'm just going to wait here for this signal so I know when it will occur. So that's kind of our signal interface. Okay. Let's talk about processes and file descriptors next. All right, so specifically, I think we'll start with the file descriptors. So if you recall, inside of kernel memory for each process, we're going to store this array of file descriptors. And each element in this array is not actually the information about a particular open file or open resource. Instead, it's just a pointer to that object that exists somewhere else, right? And so each one of these that's allocated is a pointer. The file descriptor, it becomes a pointer to the file description object that's stored somewhere else. Now, this is very convenient for a couple reasons. So first, when we want to fork a process, we want that full copy. By having this abstraction layer, when we do the fork and we do the copy, we don't actually have to copy all of that state. We just copy the file descriptor's array. And so the pointers stay the same. And so this makes it, again, makes it more efficient to get sort of that new copy of the process. It also means that the resources that were open in the parent are also open in the child, which is very convenient for having access to the same files, standard in, standard out, things like that. Now, the other nice piece of this is that we can use the duplicate or dupe2 system call to manipulate these file descriptor objects. And remember, the file descriptors are just basically indices into this array. So we might have a file descriptor which just points to that particular location in this file descriptor's array. If we had something open and we want to replace standard out with that, for example, we could do something like this, right? So we have the old and the new. And so what this would do in practice is, I guess I should have drawn this before. So let me just fill that in. Okay, so we had that. And then we had something else over here at this other file descriptor. When we duplicate this, we're basically saying, instead of this pointing here, cancel that, we're going to have it point to the open object over here. Right, and so we've duplicated that file descriptor by now having sort of this be able to point to something else, right? Something that was already opened. And this is convenient because if we wanted to do something like run our program and have it output to, you know, my file, we could do that because now we can set up so that the program just outputs a standard output like it normally does, except instead of standard output going to the terminal, it's now writing to the same file that our file descriptor 100 was set to. And so this abstraction is very convenient for the types of shell operations we looked at, as well as making fork efficient. And okay, so kind of related topic, if we have our fork call, right, we typically have something that looks like this. We do if PID is 0, do something, say then we exit. And then down here we can do wait on that child PID, right, as a way to say, okay, I want to wait, sort of not continue this program until this child process is finished. And so basically when it calls exit, and then I'll proceed from there, right? So this is a sort of our standard kind of structure for doing that. Any other questions on sort of these topics? Okay. All right. So exceptions. We've kind of been talking about them, especially we were talking about kernel mode, user mode. And we have sort of different types of exceptions with slightly different kind of terminology. So trap and exception are basically the same thing. We've mostly been using sort of exception or fault instead of trap, but trap is often sort of shorthand for something traps to the kernel. Meaning exception happens, the hardware switches to the kernel and then runs the exception handler. And so we talk about a fault, same thing. And then there's kind of a couple groups here. So we can have exceptions that sort of occur sort of internally or related to the process. So if the process calls a system call, or if the process tries to use memory that hasn't been allocated and causes a page fault, right? Those are sources of faults that are sort of internal. But we can also have things which are characterized by interrupts. So these are outside events that generate an interrupt to the processor, also signaling an event. Probably the most common is something like a timer. So a timer is a good way that allows the operating system to be able to run a user mode program, which for all it knows is going to do a lot of computation or just sit in a while loop. But the hardware will keep track of that timer. Eventually it'll expire, and then that will cause an exception, giving control back to the operating system so it can decide what to do. But there's other external interrupts as well, such as reading from disk. And so like a hard drive is like actually like spinning platters and a little seeking needle that actually has to move, right, which takes time. And so rather than sit there and wait for that, which could take an eternity in computer terms, the processor can go off and do something else. And then when that data is finally ready, then we'll get an interrupt. Or other things like waiting for button presses from users or sensors finishing, taking a reading, things like Face ID, doing its detection and it's finished. All of those kind of events are often signaled with interrupts, so the processor can do something else while that thing is working. And so those are all different class of exceptions, but sort of have different use cases and different sources. Question?
Is it going to be like MMAP stuff, or where it's like file descriptors or any events like file
writing? Trying to think how to answer that. I think the file descriptor stuff will be sort of similar to the exercises that we've seen throughout the lecture. So the same kind of like, and in the quizzes as well, right? Those same kind of like code snippets. Okay, so let's look at this question here. Spring 2023, is that one? Yes, okay, great. And that was 1A, okay. Okay, so this question is saying we have a single core machine and three processes. A series of events happens, and it's asking us, part A is saying, which steps are likely to involve a system call? Okay? All right, so if we go through these. Okay, number one, process A opens a file. Well, how does process open a file? Call the open function. What does the open function do? Call the open system call, because we need the kernel to help us actually get access to that file resource. That way the kernel can check if there's permissions or if that file actually exists. And so definitely that one is going to need a system call. Number two, process reads from the file, but the data must first be transferred from disk to memory. How does a process read from a file? Well, we're going to call the read function. What does the read function do? Calls the read system call. Because again, to get access to the data, we're going to need the kernel's help, especially in this case, right? Because we have to go all the way to disk. So we'll get two. Okay. While process A is waiting, so this is waiting for that file to actually be read, process B runs. So here, the earlier step, the process A called the system call. Now we're doing a context switch, but there's no indication there's going to be an additional system call here. So just doing that context switch doesn't imply another system call. So it won't be three. Now process B, and it's step four here, performs some computations, right? It's doing some calculation, right? Computation, just running instructions, no need to do a system call for that. The program can just do that. So no expectation that we'd have a system call in four. Now in five, process B is paused temporarily, and then process C runs, and process C performs some computations. Well, we do have a context switch, right? We went from B to C. However, why did we switch? Well, it's not entirely clear. However, process B sort of being paused, and given that it was running computations, there's no reason to think that it may want to continue those computations. Something happened, it was paused, and then the operating system decided to do the context switch to C. Well, none of those steps require a system call. And so we wouldn't expect there to be one in five. Process B resumes running and sends a signal to process C. So now process B is back being scheduled, it's executing. That doesn't really need a, there's no system call there. However, sending a signal, that definitely needs the operating system support. And so to send that signal, we're definitely going to need a system call. Now, in number seven, process C signal handler starts running. Right? So the operating system has delivered that signal and caused the handler to run in C. But that operation is handled by the OS. Process C didn't call a system call at that point just to get the handler to run. So nothing there. Now, but process C decides to print a message to the terminal. And so that's sort of using an output resource that is going to involve the kernel. Process C had to use write to do that. Write's a system call. And so that will be a system call. Now, finally in nine, finally that disk access finished. The file contents are ready and process A resumes. Well, that's going to sort of return the system call that process A had called, right? That read is going to return at this point, but there's no indication there that a new system call would be used. And so that one won't have a system call. So that's our list. Any questions about those? Yeah. So why is five not? So remember, a system call is sort of actually like the program taking action, calling the system call instruction, asking the kernel to do something. But here, the process was paused. It doesn't say that it was sort of intentionally asking to stop running. And then process C starts running, which is the kernel doing a context switch. But again, there's no indication that process C is doing a system call because it's just trying to do computations as well. Anything else on these? Why is number 9 not a system call? So what's happening in 9? So basically, we're told that the read from the disk has finished. So the data from that's in that file has been read. Okay. And as a result, now the operating system knows that this system call that process A called earlier is now finished. I can sort of return that data, give that data to that process. And so I'm going to do that and then execute process A. And so the system call that was called earlier has returned, but there's nothing in there that would need another system call to be called. Process A can read that data, use it in whatever way it wants to, but that doesn't require an additional system call. Okay, and since we're here, let's just kind of quickly go through B as well. During which of the steps is a non-system call exception likely to occur? So basically the exceptions we talked about, but not the ones that come from having a system call. So A is just the system, or sorry, option one is just the system call, the open. The read system call in 2 is also a system call, not some other exception. Number 3, while process A is waiting, process B runs. So process A called a system call. That caused an exception. The kernel sort of is like, well, I can't return the system call just yet. I have to wait for the disk to finish, so I'm going to run process B. Right, there's no additional exception that has to happen there. Number 4, process B just does some computations, no exception there. Number 5, process B is paused, and process C runs. So this one, right, so like why did process B, why was it paused? Why did it stop? It's sort of reasonable to, assume that like something like that timer fired, right? Something happened which caused the operating system to stop running B and switch to C. So we'll add that to our list. Number 6, process B resumes running and sends a signal to process C. So same intuition there, right? Process C was doing all these computations. For some reason, it stopped, likely because there was an external timer that fired that said that wanted the and the operating system decided to do the context switch back to B. Sending a signal, that's a system call. Signal handler starting running, that's just something the operating system handles, no exception there. Printing out a message, again, it's a system call, no need for an exception. And then number 9, the contents of A's files are retrieved from disk. Well, there again, so the disk is likely triggered an interrupt saying, I'd finished that last request you made of me. And so that's how the operating system knows that it's finished and can go and run process A again. And so that will be an external exception. Yep.
Why is 6 an exception but not 3?
Why is, good question. Why is 6 an exception but not 3? So the difference is what caused the operating system to want to do the context switch. So in 3, process A called a system call, and the kernel couldn't finish that right away. And so at that point, it said, well, I'm going to run something else. And so it did a context switch for that reason, but it didn't need an additional exception to occur to do that. It's already executing as a result of that system call. However, in 6, if the process was just continuing to do its computations, an external event was required to switch back to the kernel so it could decide, oh, okay, I should give this other process some time to run. So 6 is in both lists. So basically, because it has sort of two parts. So the first part, it, process B resumes running. We infer that that happened because some external event happened, exception happened, that allowed the operating system to decide to switch to B. So that's the first half. But then the second half is, well, when B started running, it didn't just do more computations, it decided to send a signal. And so that's going to be the system call. Okay, and there's another question in here. What triggers a context switch? So we see some examples here where a context switch was happening. So a context switch, remember, is when the operating system or the kernel decides is running one process and decides to switch to another. So it has to save the state on behalf of the previously executing process, restore the state on the process it's going to run next, and then actually continue running that new process. And this can happen for a variety of reasons. So we saw a couple here. So one is the process that was running asked for something that's going to take a while, like reading from the disk. And so rather than do nothing, the kernel decides, okay, I'm going to context switch to this other process, which has actual work to do. We also see an example here where the process B is running, it's doing, say, a lot of work. The operating system gets a timer interrupt and then switches to a different process, allowing that process some time to execute. And this is important, right? Because if you think about, like, you know, seeing any sort of like spinning cursor, right, showing that your computer is sitting there busy and waiting, you know, what's happening is something else is running so that the program that you're actually interacting with isn't. Or at least not enough. And so it's not being able to keep up with your interaction. And so we don't want that to happen where one program just sort of takes over. We want to be able to switch between them so that things that we're interacting with continue to be responsive. So those are some examples of when a context switch happens. Okay, anything else on this topic? Okay, all right. Let's see if I can. Okay, there was a question about virtual memory here. Okay, so this was week 6. Question 4 here. Yeah, what's going to be the right way to do this? Maybe I can go like this. Nope. Of course not. Ah, there we go. Okay. So question 4. Suppose the system has a two-level page table, 4,096 byte pages, 30-bit virtual addresses. Okay? Now, we're given that the virtual addresses are divided into a 9-bit first part of the virtual page number, 9-bit part of the second part of the virtual page number, and then 12-bit offset. And if we do the math, 9 plus 9 plus 12 is 30, so that gives us all of the bits. And we're saying that we're given that we have entries for a variety of things. And the question is, what is the minimum number of second level page tables stored? Right. Okay. So to answer this, we have to think about kind of what is this question like asking? Like how would we know how many second-level page tables are stored? And so if we kind of try to diagram this, right, we have our first level with some known base pointer address. Now, a second-level table is stored or exists, right, if we have an entry at a unique place in the first-level table. Right, so if there's somewhere in here where, you know, we're getting a pointer to another page table, well, then if that entry exists over here, then we need to have that page table sort of populated with the second level so we can do the next lookup. Okay? And so, to answer this question, we basically have to think about, well, how many entries are valid in the first level? And that count will tell us how many pages need to be allocated at the second level. So we're given a list of virtual addresses which have been allocated. And to answer this, we only need to consider the entries in the first table. So we only need to consider the first part of the virtual page number, right? So if we have our virtual address, right, 9, 9, and 12 bits, this is our virtual page number and virtual page number 1. We only really need to consider this first part because that's what we use for our lookup, right, into this table, is this first virtual page number. Okay, so if we look at our first set of entries, we have virtual page 1, 2, and 3 corresponding to these addresses. So if we look at one of those addresses here, well, conveniently, right, these are multiples of 4 bits, so 3 of them is 12. And so then we have a 1 for virtual page number 2, and then everything else is going to be zeros. So we know VPN 1 is just 0. And if we look at those other addresses, right, 2 and 3, right, the same thing is going to apply, right? The virtual page number... the first virtual page number is still going to be 0. And so if we look at our page table over here, we're always going to go to the same first page table entry. So that's going to be 1 second-level page table we're going to have allocated for that first page table entry in the first table. If we look at this next one here, so this is given as address 0x9, and then I believe... it's that, right? Yep. And so this is still our offset. So that's the 12 bits for the offset, so we can ignore that. If we write out this, the virtual page number in binary, right, we get... we get that. Now, if we break that down into our 9-bit chunks, we're going to need, that's 4 plus 3 is 7, so we're 2 additional zeros there. And so this becomes our virtual page number, or VPN 1. And so this is definitely different than 0, right? So there's some other entry in here that we have to have. So we had 1 here. We're going to have 2 here, right? Because that's going to map to a different second-level page table. Okay, so that's our second one. Now, if we look at this next one, so address 0x910... so that's still our offset. And we break this down, right? 1, 0. And so even though we have this extra one bit here, but that's in virtual page number 2, so that's going to be our second lookup. Our first lookup is going to match the one from before. So that's going to map to the same page table entry. So we're not going to need an additional second level page table for that, for this sort of third virtual page OX9100. Now, finally, we have this last one here, OX1FFFF000, right? So that's still our offset. We're going to, if we look at this, well, you know, pretty clearly, right, we get all ones here. And if we look at this 9, okay, so that's our VPN2. But now, clearly, our VPN1 has changed, right? We have, you know, it's definitely a different number than what we had before, so we're going to have another entry in here somewhere. That's going to map to another second level. And so that'll be our third. And so in effect, the question becomes, how many unique VPN1s do we have? And the answer is 3. Yeah, the first three here, so these are the, like this one, OX1000, and then it was 2000, 3000. If we expand these, right, so this is always going to be the offset to the right here. And then we look at here, we're only sort of changing that those lower four bits. Those are going to be all in the virtual page number 2. By the time we get over to virtual page number 1, it's just zeros, right? Now, they're not shown here because we don't write out a bunch of extra characters, but they're all just going to be 0 for all 3 of those pages, which means the first level lookup is going to be the same, and the differentiation is going to happen in the second level. But we're still just going to have just one allocated second level page table for all of those pages. Yeah.
So I think that because you don't have 3 different VPN1 numbers on the first level, but I'm wondering why can't those just all point to the same second level page table, so it's only one?
So far, right, I've said we definitely have these 3 different page table entries because we have 3 different virtual page number ones, which means we have 3 different lookups. But like, what if those all just pointed to the same next level page table? Then we certainly wouldn't have 3 second level page tables, but our memory system wouldn't work. Because what we would end up having is we'd have 2 different addresses where if they had different, so the virtual addresses would have different virtual page number ones. But if they had the same virtual page number 2s, they would end up mapping to the same page table entry in the second level, which means they would share the same physical page. And so if you can imagine, we'd have basically 2 virtual addresses, so 2 addresses in our program, which, because of the way the page table was set up, actually access the same memory, which would be very bad. Right, because we expect that if we have 2 different addresses, they're pointing to 2 different locations. And so we know that these actually do have to be separate second level tables because they represent different mappings for different addresses. Anything else? Okay. I got one other thing lined up here, so let me open that. 2024. Okay. So this is, what, 5? Oh, it's three. Okay. So this question is a little bit involved, and it definitely kind of combines some, you know, some things that we haven't talked about yet, like side channel attacks. I think it's actually more productive to just look at a simpler kind of version of this question. So let's take from it the cache here, right? So we have this this cache structure, okay? So we're given the total size, and we're given that it's 256 byte blocks. We're also told that it's direct mapped, which is why we're talking about it right now, okay? So what does that mean? Well, if we're going to have 256 byte blocks, that means we need 8 bits for our offset, okay? Now, if our total cache size is 2 to the 14 and we have 8 bits for offsets, that means we have 6 bits left for our index, and then everything else is going to be the tag. Okay? So that's kind of what we saw last time looking at caches. Now, this question is sort of asking if we had certain data structures in memory at different locations in memory, what addresses would they look up to then access certain locations of the cache? And so kind of without going through all the details of this particular question, a simpler version is basically if we assume we have some cache block here, and let's say this is index 04, or index 4, basically. Right, so what would it take for a program to access memory such that it is going to use this particular block or set in the cache? Okay, so to think about this, right, if we think about an address, well, we're going to have 8 bits, which are just the offset. So those are essentially irrelevant, right? Those are bits are only going to tell us where in that block we are. They're not going to tell us which index we're going to. It's the next bits which are going to tell us the index, right? And then everything over here is going to be the tag. And so these are 6 bits, so we're going to have, bit, 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 bit. So these 6 bits are going to tell us which index. And so if we had, say, memory address 0x4xx, right, because the bottom bits are don't care, that will map to that index. But similarly, if we had, say, something like this, right, so that 1 is well above, so that's in the tag bits, the index is going to be the same. And so if we do a memory read to this address, and then we do a memory read to this address, what's going to happen is the cache will be populated the first time with the first read, but then the second read comes through, uses the same index in that cache, and then is going to evict what was there and replace it with whatever memory is at the second location. Any questions? I know this doesn't answer the full question. The other, the question basically boils down to making sure that we keep track of that this is an int, and so if we index into that array, we have to divide by 4. But the question's sort of asking the same kind of concept. So I just wanted to for time reasons, just kind of highlight this concept. So if you can think through like when, what has to be true of an address for it to use the same index in the cache, that's, I think, the real takeaway from here. All right, that's our time. Thanks, everyone. I'll see you on Tuesday.